Welcome back to Living Our Breast Lives, a podcast not only about two women thriving with metastatic breast cancer, but also self-love, appreciation, and overall awakening to this beautiful gift we call life. Each episode, we will be focusing on a different theme that will highlight each episode. Please don't forget to not only tune in, but to also subscribe and review. Welcome back, and thank you for tuning into our podcast, Living Our Breast Lives. My name is Ren, and with me is Kate.
Hi. I don't know why. It feels like it's been a minute since we've been here, but it really hasn't. But hi, everyone.
It does kind of feel that way. I agree.
It's been a busy month.
It has been, absolutely, especially with our segment that we've been doing.
Yes.
So we have a really kick-ass episode for you today. As you've noticed, this month on our Instagram page, we've been featuring stories of triple negative thrivers in honor of Triple Negative Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Triple negative breast cancer survivors and thrivers get an entire month of acknowledgement for multiple reasons. I would say the main reason being because of its lower survival rates in comparison to other subtypes due to just the aggressiveness of the disease. Well, that is why Kate and I came up with the idea to feature and showcase uplifting, hopeful stories from 24 MBC thrivers in the community with this exact subtype. For me, these stories deserve to be shared for, a number of reasons. First, to build up our community so, of course, we feel less alone. Second, to connect thrivers with shared and very similar experiences. And third, just to acknowledge that you can, in fact, thrive and beat the odds as a metastatic triple negative breast cancer thriver. And to prove that last statement, oh, I'm so excited for this. We have a very special 10-year metastatic triple negative breast cancer thriver joining us on the pod today to officially close out Triple Negative Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And yes, I said 10 freaking years. Not only will her interview bring us lots of hope for the triple neg community, but it will, of course, teach us the importance of clinical trials, funding, and research when it comes to a diagnosis as complex as this one. But before introducing our guest for today, let's first explain what the heck triple negative breast cancer is, because, obviously that's important. So I'm going to pass it over to you, Kate.
Thanks. You know that I love all things science about this. So I'll keep it high level, but triple negative is a subtype of breast cancer that accounts for about 10 to 15% of breast cancer diagnoses. It's more commonly diagnosed in women under 40 and in Black women and in women who have the BRCA1 mutation. As you'll recall, the last two episodes with Cheryl and Deltra, they had triple negative as well. So it is common in our community, but it as a whole, it's not as common as the other diagnoses. So why is it called triple negative? Well, because unlike hormone positive or HER2 positive or triple positive disease, triple neg lacks hormone receptors or an overproduction of the HER2 protein, making many targeted therapies like myself, I'm on targeted therapies for hormone and for HER2. They don't work because there aren't those receptors or there isn't that overproduction. So a lot of those targeted and sometimes less harsh treatments aren't effective in this subtype. That, coupled with the aggressiveness of TNBC, equates to a 5-year survival rate that's less than half of the next highest 5-year survival rate. So that's unfortunately why, like to Ren's point, that's why we're talking about it, because there does need to be awareness. There does need to be action. So that's the background. I'll turn it back over to Ren.
Yeah. And that's exactly why we are, given an entire month, right? It's harsh, but for this reason, long-term survivors in this space are rare. It's just the harsh.
It doesn't have to be harsh. I think that's why we're here today. It doesn't have to be. None of this has to be the way that it is with action over awareness and adequate funding and clinical trials. And a focus, it doesn't have to be this for anyone. I think that's why we do what we do, Ren, right?
Absolutely.
It doesn't have to be.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't have to. Like, it can be a chronic disease moving forward. It can be. That's why research and funding are just so important. And I will say it's definitely not too late to make a donation. Kate and I have the BCRF link posted in our Instagram bio. If anybody wants to make a generous contribution for TNBC month, that would be phenomenal. So our special guest for today, for me personally, it's going to be an emotional one just because of how much it kind of like hits home for me. But she was actually our very last Thriver of the Month featured in our MTNBC segment. And I mean, there's obviously a reason for that because I've already said it before, like 10 freaking years. But before I officially introduce her to you all, I wanted to briefly share how I first found her, because the story is absolutely ridiculous, but I still believe it to be fate to this day. So long story short, my husband and I were sitting at the mechanics. We're waiting for our oil change when we hear the word Tecentriq from a nearby TV in the waiting room. And when I tell you, the most random, because at this point, I had only been on the medication for maybe like a year, maybe pushing a year and a half. And like, you don't hear the word Tecentriq in, you know, outside of an oncologist's office. And so Tecentriq is the immunotherapy treatment that I'm currently on, that I've been on for 3.5 years, that's been keeping me NED for all this time. So that was actually the first moment I heard the story on the Charlotte local news about a young mom whose decision to join a phase one clinical trial back in 2015 saved her life. But it's not just any clinical trial, right? It's the clinical trial that also saved my life 5 years later when I was first diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer. Because in order for a drug to become FDA approved, it needs to go through the clinical trial phases first. So without this specific trial, and of course, this certain brave individual that decided to put it all on the line and take a risk, not only for herself, but for all the future Thrivers, I might have not been here today. Ooh, okay. So I told you it was going to be an emotional one for me. So without further ado, let me introduce to you our lucky charm, Stephanie.
Oh, Ren, you already have me all teary-eyed. I am so happy we found each other.
I really am too. And I'm so just happy that you were willing to join us today. You're just such an inspiration, not only just to Kate and I, but the whole Triple Neg community, all of the MBC Thrivers. I mean, it's just surreal to also finally meet you in person after messaging with you for so long. So how are you doing today? Let's start with that.
Well, my makeup is getting a little bit watery right now, but I am great. I mean, we all have our happy faces, right? That when people ask how you're doing, oh, I'm good. I'm all good because I'm here. Does every day come with pain and struggles and what I have classified now as my chronic disease? Cancer can truly, like you said, be treated as a chronic illness, an autoimmune illness. It doesn't have to be the death sentence that it has been for so many, because there are all the time these amazing treatments that are coming available.
I also love that you just manifested that it is a chronic condition. I like that. I think that moving forward, I think that's what I'm going to, that's what I'm going to call it. If that's what helps me, you know, and helps others, like it can get there. It can be that. But I really appreciate you for sharing that. I mean, knowing that you're living a fairly normal life is, I don't know, it's very hopeful. And I think that's the end goal, right? Like being able to, gosh, work a full-time job, raise children, have ambition and goals, like all while having MBC. Like I agree, it doesn't have to be a death sentence. And as Kate said, we can get there by funding, by research, by advocacy. We can get there where this is a chronic condition.
Absolutely.
And to that point, I think it's important to recognize the advancements that have been made just in a short amount of time. I was diagnosed in March of 2020, And since then, I think I have 3 new therapies that have been added to my treatment lines. And I think the way that my oncologist has explained it is, and it's just semantics, but it helps me in my brain. So if it helps anybody else, he's always said, you have incurable cancer, but you are not terminal until you don't have any options. So as long as you're one step behind the next option that comes out for you, you do have incurable, it's chronic. And so that in my brain always helps me calm down that I'm not out of options. I'm just incurable right now. And that's chronic. That's, you know, it's not terminal till you don't have options. And with science, we can have options.
I love that. Gosh, I just got the chills. Y'all, we are sitting here with chronic conditions, okay? That is what we are manifesting moving forward.
Absolutely.
All right. So Stephanie, if you are ready to officially get started, I think we can get into the first question of who is Stephanie outside of being an MBC Thriver?
My paragraph intro of myself, a mom first and foremost. I'm also a daughter, a sister, a friend, a giggler, explorer of all things beautiful and whatever I can learn, whether it's learning my place in the world, all the places and cultures of the world, and most importantly, always striving to be a better human being. I think people who are told you have this many more months to live, get your affairs in order. I think you could hear a million stories of people that are like kind of this second chance awareness kind of thing. I have just always focused on just being the best me I can be. No regrets. I love learning from other people. I love being a mom so I can guide and teach my child humility. He's probably the most empathetic human being I've ever met, whereas over the years, I think we can all agree that empathy is a lacking characteristic in many, if you look out in the broader world today. And I'm super proud of that, that even though he's had to watch his mom suffer so much, in the end, it will make him a better human being. And I take pride in that because I am not just somebody that's fighting a disease that feels like she's dying all the time and wonders sometimes, maybe when I die, it will finally stop hurting. Yep, that's not an option today. So onward and upward and ignoring it and my happy face.
I appreciate your honesty with that.
Yeah, that answer is just, I think for everyone listening, that hits home that so much of what society expects from us is that smiling, brave, bald fighter, that fighter mentality. And we don't have a choice to be a fighter, right? The opposite is to die. So you do have to do it. But it changes for me, at least minute to minute. I can be, to your point, thinking that I don't want to do this anymore. Like, my side effects are awful. This is not the life that I want to have. And then the next minute, it's like, what trials are out there? Let me just go ahead and take a look and see what's out there that I could maybe check out. So it's minute to minute. And I think as long as you, at the end of the day, I've always said, and I've said on the podcast before, you can have all kinds of meltdowns all you want. You can have a day-long meltdown. You can have a 5-minute meltdown. You just can't unpack and live in that space. And so as long as you're packing up your meltdown and moving forward, that's sometimes all we can do. But I love what you said, that there are times that you do feel like that. And then you just realize that, no, the alternative of death is not where I'm at today. I don't want that today.
Kate's right. Like, in that moment, it's, yes, we are strong because of the choices that we have to make, and just tiresome efforts of everything you have to go through in those first months. But at the end of the day, you want to choose to live. You want to do what you need to do to be here on the other end, living a fairly normal life, being there for your loved ones, and of course, doing your hardest to be happy in the everyday life. And so you're not really given much of a choice in that moment, but to kick ass and, you know, keep your head held high and to keep on trucking along.
I remember when I was about
12 or 13 years old, my mom's mom, my grandmother, was having dizzy episodes and she fainted, ended up in the hospital, and lo and behold, she had brain cancer. We now, all these years later, right, think of the time frame of that in the 80s. It was a woman's disease, dirty women's diseases. And when she had lumps and there was question, they didn't really ever do anything, and she probably didn't do the follow-up. So we really do believe it was metastatic breast cancer that had gone to the brain, which eventually killed her. But I remember being in the hospital room and her sitting up in the bed and saying, "I will do whatever it takes. I just want to be here." And my mom, who's a nurse, and the doctor is sitting there saying, "There's nothing. There is nothing that can be done." And I have played that scenario in my head many times. And that wasn't the option for me. And I'm so grateful that, and sad over the women that that was their really only option, because they didn't understand it. I mean, they still look at how much we still say there needs to be research, there needs to be funding. And we're talking, what, 40 years ago? But it was something that always stuck with me so hard. And I was not going to ever have that be. There was always an option, as long as I was willing to still be a pain in the doctor's ass.
Rightfully so. I would say I'm the exact same way. I'm sure Kate is too. Sometimes that's the route that we have to take to get shit done. But also, I'm really sorry that you had to experience that.
Oh, thank you. I think who in this world hasn't been touched by a sad cancer story of someone you love?
I know. I wish it didn't have to be that way.
Yeah. Well,
it's definitely hard. And I think for all of us, it's I can't speak for everybody, but I know for Ren and I, and it sounds like for you, Stephanie, that kind of lights the fire. That's why, you know, we've talked about, as long as I'm in a place where I can advocate, because as hard as this disease is to manage, at the end of the day, I'm pretty lucky that my side effects are manageable. They're not awful. So as long as I can keep being a voice and a face to this, I will, because we know in this space, the rates don't allow for a lot of long-term survivors or a long-term advocate. So if I can lead the way until I can't anymore, then I hope somebody behind me will do that too. And this can stop being part of everyone's story. But with that, I think it's probably a good transition. We always ask our guests to tell us their MBC story. I know for long-term survivors, it's like, well, how much time do you have? But tell us whatever you want to tell us about your story with MBC.
Well, my son was 2 years old. I was picking him up at the side of the pool. It was like late August, September. And when I picked him up, I felt something under my right arm, just kind of in the armpit area. I'm like, that doesn't feel right. My mom's a nurse, as I mentioned. My sister's a paramedic. So I immediately pulled them back into the back room. Feel this. And they were both kind of, oh, it's probably just a nose, it's inflamed, something. But you should definitely get it checked out. It took forever to get just an appointment at my primary care. 30 days antibiotic, went back, another 30 days of antibiotic. And I'm like, it feels a little bit bigger. And you're 37 years old, Stephanie, you don't have breast cancer. There's no need to be paranoid. And I'm like, well, you know, we've always kind of questioned about my grandmother, and my mom's at this point was twice a breast cancer survivor. So just being cautious, as we're supposed to do, as you guys always tell us we're supposed to be. On the third time I went back, it was definitely larger, and she sent me for an ultrasound. Went right away. And the tech left the room for a second to say that she needed to go talk to someone else. Well, I, of course, turned and looked at the screen and saw a big black blob on the screen and knew exactly what it was. I got referred to a surgeon. The surgeon was wanting to do an MRI. The insurance company was saying it needed to be a mammogram and biopsy. So it was months and months and months of fighting of what is going to happen next. What does she need to have happen next? What's covered under insurance? Getting on cancellation lists, constantly calling the doctors, because at the same time, it was getting bigger. And finally, right after Thanksgiving, they finally agreed with the insurance company to have a mammogram and a biopsy. The mammogram showed completely clear. even though I had a 7-centimeter tumor that was diagnosed right then with the biopsy as triple negative, stage 3C. Again, that mammogram was completely clear. It showed nothing because my breast tissue was so dense. Within days, I had gotten a phone call at home confirming the diagnosis, appointment the next afternoon to start treatment options and go from there. It was overwhelming, to say the least. I think anybody that goes through a new diagnosis, the number of doctor's appointments and the clinics where all the doctors come together to discuss your treatments and all those things was overwhelming. But one thing I had realized right at the beginning was this is very rare. It's very aggressive. It's very advanced. There is no time for anything other than to start fighting back immediately. And within a week, I was in a chemo chair for my first treatments. I did chemo. They said 6 to 8 weeks later, I could have my mastectomy. On day 1 of week 6, I was on the operating table. They said I could have radiation 6 to 8 weeks after the mastectomy. On day 1 of week 6, I was on the radiation table. I was not playing at all. I had anaphylactic reactions to the chemo, the very last chemo. So they moved it to a different type. I still had anaphylactic reaction with that, but not as bad if they titrated it very slowly. And it took 8 hours on one day, and there was just a little bit left in the bag. And they said, it's unstable. We can't give you the rest of it. And I said, I'll be back here at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning, mix it up, and I'll get the rest of it. It was for sure crazy. I was BRCA negative. We talked about, obviously, triple negative, but BRCA negative. I had all the genetic testings done, and most cancer patients have between 3 to 5 genetic mutations. I had 15, thanks mom and dad. So after I finished the radiation, that was August. In October, I had clean scans, no evidence of disease. My sister threw a huge, like, she's cancer-free party, but I was having headaches, really weird headaches. And right before Thanksgiving, went for a scan at like 7:30 at night. The very next morning at 8 o'clock, I was getting my son ready. I had an appointment with my oncologist at 1, but I was getting my son ready to go to daycare for the day. And the nurse from the oncologist's office about 7:15 calls the house. And she's like, we need you to get in here right away. And I'm like, Heidi, what's going on? You need to tell me. She's like, sweetie, I can't tell you anything, but we need you to get here right away. So I dropped my son off. And I went and they pulled up the scans, and in my head was a brain tumor, because unbeknownst to me, because they can't tell you all the scariness of chemo and all the possibilities, because you would be sitting there for a lifetime hearing all of it. My cancer was super smart. And while it was beating up my body with the chemo treatments, we have this blood-brain barrier that protects our brain. My cancer knew to go right into my head and hide there. So the headaches were explained. That afternoon, I met with my surgical oncologist, and in less than a week, I was on the table having my first craniotomy to remove the brain tumor. I then had 1 dose of stereotactic radiation. And a year later, after watching the head thing and all the symptoms returning, on Halloween 2014, I had my second craniotomy, same spot, just deeper because it was still growing into my brain. And that was followed by 5 weeks of partial brain radiation every day. If you think about any of us moms out there that go through pregnancy brain, mom brain, and total that in with chemo brain, tumor brain, radiation brain, it is like, I don't even know how I continued to work, function, any of it. When I think back on so much of it, it was a fog. After all of that, in April 2015, a small spot showed up in the middle of my brachial plexus in my shoulder. Well,
oncology and everybody, they're, oh, it's great. We're just going to watch, we'll wait and see what it does. And I was like, but shouldn't we be figuring out something to kill it instead of chasing it all over my body now while it's in something that could eventually paralyze my right shoulder and arm? No big deal. It's not a lung. It's not the heart. It's not these important organs. It's not my brain. How do we figure out to kill it now? And it was, well, we can try this, or we can just keep wait and watch. We'll do scans every 2 months and watch. And I was not happy with that. But then I found out that the woman whose research is based on triple negative, well, she's right at Chapel Hill. I will go to her. So I made all the treks to Chapel Hill to, at the end of all the tests and reviewing all the clinical trials that were available, was told, sweetheart, you have stage 4 cancer. You can live your life the best you can. You can have the happiness, but there is no cure for you. You need to go home. You need to be happy. You need to eventually go on palliative care and hospice. And that is all I can offer you. I was sitting up on the table. My husband at the time and my mom were sitting there. I looked right at her and leaned forward and I said, your bedside manner sucks. I have a 5-year-old at home now. That is not an option for me. You're a fucking bitch. I stood up. I said, get your things. We're leaving. And we did. And I never spoke to her again, except for every month when I have my clean scans, I tell my oncologist now to send it to her with my regards.
I have chills. I mean, oh my God.
That's amazing. Not to detract, but I had a doctor say the same thing, that she could give me 2 years. I was NED at the time. And I send her a card every year on my diagnosis date that I'm still here.
And I can attest to that too, because I had a doctor as well. It was actually one of my second opinion doctors. She had told me, good luck on your endeavor. The Tecentriq will usually work anywhere from 4 to 6 months. And so every year at the same time, I will send her an email that says, hey, it's just me, still kicking, still here. Just wanted to let you know the Tecentriq is still working for your girl over here.
Yeah, I actually had, after the first brain tumor was removed, I was meeting with my radiation oncologist. And he was like, well, do you want to know what your survival rate is now? And I was like, yes, please. And my mom and my husband at the time were, no, we don't want to, we don't want you to have to hear that kind of thing. And I was like, I want to see. And so here it was in August of 2014. I'd had the surgery in November. And he was like, from November, you would have had 7.5 months. And I was like, well, I don't see it happening anytime soon. So your math sucks. Next. Like, I just was like, every time somebody said to me, no, and even when I had the genetic testing done and it came back with all the genetic markers and what clinical trials would possibly help me, I again went to Duke and to Chapel Hill and to my doctors locally saying, I don't know what all of this means. I work in marketing for a bank, but I want to understand it. So can you help me look at these different trials and tell me what would be something that could help me? And my one doctor said, oh, you should go to Vanderbilt. That's a good one. Why? Well, because Vanderbilt's my alma mater. Thanks, doc. I'm going to need a little bit better reason than that. And so when I got no help there, I started reaching out to the clinical trial directors myself, emailing, calling. I had a stack of paperwork in front of me. It was insane, like seriously, like 3 feet tall. And I was just reading and highlighting and marking and calling, and brought me right back around to Charlotte. And I am so fortunate that I was able to find something close to home, not be traveling across the country or even the world, I've heard some people. And they made every exception for me to get onto the trial. And on a whim and a prayer, I remember sitting down in the pool with my son. He was going to start kindergarten that fall, August. It was like July. And I had a long talk with him. So there's this medication that could really help mommy, and it could make her be here for a very long time.
but it's going to make me at first very sick because it was the Tecentriq along with the Abraxane, which is like a chemo light. But he was going to watch my hair fall out a little bit more, and just who knew what all the side effects were going to be. And we agreed, the two of us, me and my five-year-old, that it was worth the chance. And I guess it was, because by 2018, I was considered cancer-free. And ever since then, every scan is free.
Your story is so touching. I mean, and the fierceness that just from behind a screen, like, I can just feel it. It is miraculous that you took things into your own hands and you made it happen. You made all the hard calls, even the stack of papers, the fact that you were calling the clinical trials, the doctors yourself. We always talk about how being your own advocate is so important, but you know, Stephanie, I just feel like you took it to a whole nother level, and just look at where you are today. It is remarkable. It's admirable. It's motivating. Have you met any other double digit metastatic triple negative breast cancer thrivers during this time?
No. Nope. My gynecologist once told me that at the very beginning that she had a patient that was 20 years out. So that gave me hope. I've never met, no. Mm-mm.
Because you're the hope for me. You've been that hope for me.
You're going to be even longer. I've already said I'm here until at least 98. I don't know why I picked that number, but that's the number it's going to be, and anything less is unacceptable.
I think that's a good number. I like that number. And honestly, after everything that you've done advocating for yourself, I can see it happening. I really can. So are your doctors, like, what do they say about you? Like, are they equally as shocked?
Yep. So I don't really talk to the doctor at Chapel Hill much, but
I wonder why.
She gets my updates because I make sure of that, but no, I mean, they say to me, you're the one in the million. You're the one it worked on. You're our goal for everybody. I would not be here if I didn't take those steps and have that. I don't know if it was crazy. I don't know if it was drive. I don't know if it was a lot of everything. I wanted to understand everything and anything that was being done to me, and anything. I went from a marketing manager at a bank to understanding this science side of things and health side that I had no interest in ever. My mom had always wanted me to go into the medical side, and I was like, ew, gross, no.
At this point, you could probably run the clinical trial yourself.
They have me as kind of an ambassador for people that start new clinical trials. Would they mind if they want to talk to somebody that's been on it? So of course I'm that person. But yeah, if it hadn't been for my own advocacy and doctors allowing me to go in with my list of questions at every appointment, be prepared. Sometimes I'd send them ahead to the nurse just to say, I'm going to need this time. So make him aware that it's not going to be a rush, rush, rush. Stephanie's got her legal pad of paper questions.
Gosh, I love it. I'm so proud to know you.
I'm proud to know you too, because when you first reached out to me, and so I had said in the beginning, oh, I would never, never say never. I would never do a clinical trial. I'm not going to be somebody's like lab rat. No way. I want proven therapies. Well, there was really nothing for triple negative. And to start a phase 1 clinical trial, that's the one that they even say, if you're doing research on trials, try to stay away from, because it's so early. And like I said, on a wing and a prayer, I said, this is the one. And holy shit, it worked.
So Stephanie, I know when you told us your MBC story and then what you've just told us, the trial is really at the center of this, and you really pushed to be part of this trial. The trial, the drug is why you're here. So can you tell us a little bit more about what the trial is, what your trial experience was? I know a lot of our listeners, to your point earlier, trials are a little bit scary and they think they're going to be a guinea pig, or they're not going to get a drug and it's going to negatively impact them. So can you share kind of what you went through, how it's working, what the trial was, just the experience overall?
Sure. So it's Abraxane, which is kind of like a chemo light, because it's my understanding that they have to give a standard of care treatment with the new trial drug, so that there is, if the trial drug doesn't work, the patient isn't just not getting anything. So I started the Abraxane and 10-Centriq in June 2015. I think I mentioned earlier, my son started school in August, and by December, I was in the hospital. I was having horrible breathing issues. They did a scan, and my oncology staff was coming to the hospital that everybody was like, this is it for her. Because with immunotherapy, it can cause almost like an autoimmune response. So my son brought home some little bug from kindergarten, right? And it went into my lungs, and they call it popcorn lung. It literally just exploded in my lungs. My pulse ox was down to like 82, I think, by the time I finally got into the hospital. Everybody thought it was cancer. They thought that it had just taken over and exploded. But really, it was just this little bug that made it amplified in my body because of being on this immunotherapy. The simplest way that I can understand the way the trial drug immunotherapy works is, whereas cancer, when it invades our bodies don't fight back like we do with a flu or any kind of infection. Our bodies will run temperatures to try to burn it off. We'll have all other sorts of symptoms, but cancer, for some reason, it just is allowed to take over until it kills us. The immunotherapy identifies those cancer cells, and they attack those cancer cells and kill them. And I think it's the coolest thing, because you're using your own body to fight it. It's not this broad spectrum chemo, which just kills good, bad, everything, and mostly the patient too, if they're not strong enough to handle it. They're even doing further things with immunotherapy now, where if you have active cancer in your body, they can take a piece of it, those T cells, those fighters of our immune system, and train them to fight your specific cancer. Put those T cells back into your body, and anytime a cell of that cancer shows up, your body's going and fighting it itself. I just think that's so cool.
RT changed the game in blood cancers like a bit ago, and it's the issue, again, I'm like going to geek out. The issue with solid cell tumors is there's like essentially like an extra lock and key that's very difficult for a T cell to unlock to get into the cell. But there's actually like, there's been a lot of advancements, and there's currently a breast cancer trial for CAR T therapy. Cause I looked into it. There are some schools of thought that that's our best chance at having this really be, for some people, cured. But there's a trial, I think, at City of Hope for breast cancer, and because they've kind of figured out how they can bypass that lock and key a little bit easier, I guess. Yeah, I like geek out over that, because that's like that piece and the training your immune system, and not burning down the forest for one tree, essentially, is so, that changes the game for everybody that's been through chemo, knows that if there's something that it's less aggressive and works actually better, like, yes, sign us all up. Yes.
Yeah, I totally agree.
And I will also say that like my specific subtype, it did not respond well to just your regular chemotherapy. Like I had growth during all of my early stage treatments. And it was not until I found the Abraxane paired with the immunotherapy that I was able to finally get a hold on the progression that kept happening. It wasn't until my body actually experienced that immunotherapy that there was active change within my body. And I just always thought to myself, like, if the immunotherapy with science advancements, if it wasn't there, I don't know that I would be sitting here today. And it's just, science is cool, man. These advancements are thrilling, to say the least. And so it's just remarkable how far we've come. It really is.
Totally agree. And I mean, so when I had first been looking at clinical trials, I had the genetic trials that were options, but it was like, I have 15 genetic mutations. Which one do I pick? Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. And the more I didn't honestly know a whole lot about autoimmune diseases. I think we've heard more about all the different kinds of autoimmune diseases that are out there. And when I finally heard somebody say to me, cancer can truly be considered an autoimmune disease, something that can be controlled over a lifetime, it was like, ding, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. And it truly can be viewed as an autoimmune disease. It's your own body attacking your body. How do you make it stop doing that? And it can be controlled, finally, instead of just broad swipe, everything killed.
And that's why you're currently experiencing a lot of these side effects, right?
Oh, yeah. What do they call it in the doctor's office? The amplification, the inflammation of, so because my body, as yours is, Ren, in this constant heightened immuno state, waiting to see if there's something that it needs to attack. And so, gosh, get something like COVID or just this little bug that my son brought home when he was in kindergarten, and it can go and get blown out of control. So you just have to be super careful in what you subject yourself to. If you get tired, it's going to be amplified. If you have a headache, it's going to be amplified. If you have a runny nose, again, everything is amplified. Yay!
Let me just take a minute there, though, because I think Ren and Stephanie both and myself, for the listeners who listen because they know us or they like what we're talking about but aren't part of the cancer community, this is why during COVID and even after COVID, this is why your friends that have chronic conditions are so serious about masking and separation, because it's not just COVID. It's that COVID might just feel like a cold to us, but everything it triggers after is serious. It can impact our treatments, our availability to get treatments. It can impact, I know I kind of shared on the pod, when I had COVID, it triggered what's called reactive arthritis. And for 6 months, I like cried every day because I thought I had Mets in my hip, and I didn't. I had a side effect of COVID that was compounded, but it was miserable. I was miserable for 6 months. My hip hurt so bad. And it was because I caught COVID. Thankfully, I was vaccinated. But again, what they're talking about right now, they're on a treatment that getting a cold, getting bronchitis, getting anything can really cause a setback and impact their health. And so it's so important that if you have people that you love with chronic conditions, that you're aware that what you're bringing around them, that you're masking, that if you don't feel even a little bit well, like if you feel a little bit bad, tell them, let them tell you if they want you to still hang out or come around. But just so everyone has that awareness, because I know COVID is different now. It's, people look at it differently, but we still have to be careful. And that's why. So that's my PSA.
No, I agree completely. Yeah, no, because it's for everybody else. I mean, that might not have a chronic condition. Life has gone back to normal, but for us, it's exactly the same. Like, we still have weakened immune systems, especially right after we have treatment. And so I am right there with you that I absolutely appreciate when I'm supposed to, like, you know, hang out with somebody or I have plans socially, that somebody says, hey, I'm kind of feeling under the weather. I just wanted to let you know ahead of time. I think that's respectful. And I think that gives you the option to make that choice on whether you want to take that risk or you want to just kind of like hang back and maybe reschedule for a different time. So Tecentriq, also known as Atezo, it was approved for adult patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer if the tumor associated immune cells expressed PD-L1. But if I'm not mistaken, when you were tested way back when, 7 years ago, your tumor did not express PD-L1 immune cell positivity, but they still took you on with the clinical trial. So how does that make you feel, knowing you were made this exception and this freaking drug is still working for you 7 years later?
Like the one in the million, the winner of the lottery of life, of something I had zero control over and was on a wing and a prayer, able to try it. And here's this one piece of criteria that they made for everybody else, yet I didn't, and it worked on me. It's crazy.
That gives me chills. It really does.
So, Stephanie, I know we kind of chatted before the recording, and you had shared that this immunotherapy is no longer approved. The trial didn't result in approval, but you shared a really interesting piece of information about why that may be. So can you share kind of your thoughts on it not being approved, but also what you had talked about with maybe there's going to be more research into it in the future?
The way it was explained to me by my oncologist is that the way the study was actually set up, however that means, I'm sure there's many, many, when you're dealing with the FDA, very specific, rigorous steps that need to be followed, and sample sizes and survival rates, long-term survival rates, that they decided it wasn't the FDA that pulled it from approval. It was Genentech that pulled it so that they could take a step back, redo the study, and then put it back out to be able to get the FDA approval and that long-term survival rate. So hopefully that means, in my layman terms, that they are still pushing forward with this drug, and patients like Ren, you getting it in the clinical setting and showing long-term survival rates will hopefully push them to continue doing the research and make it again be available in the clinical setting.
So that brings up a good point. With it not being available in a clinical, for, I guess this is for Ren and Stephanie both, can patients in the U.S. still get the drug? And if so, how do they do that?
I think anything is a possibility. You just have to know the questions to ask. Unfortunately, my ex-husband used to always say, there's a reason why they call it practicing medicine, because they don't know the answers. And especially with these cancer super survivors, as I've seen, the Wall Street Journal did an article a couple of years ago of these patients that have gotten these immunotherapy drugs, and it's like the insurance companies, the drug companies, the doctors, they don't really know what to do, because we're writing it as we're living it, because there isn't anybody else that's survived. It's overwhelming. It's take a step back and take a deep breath, and all the cliche stuff of really taking a full accounting of your life and making sure that you're truly worthy of being that one way out on the right-hand side of that bell curve. I hope that they will find a way to get it back out. In the meantime, it's my understanding that Keytruda functions very similarly. It's just different. I don't know the science of it. I do know that, like, so during my fight, a family member was diagnosed with lung cancer, had done the initial chemo treatments, and then they were going to start him on an immunotherapy, Opdivo. And at the time, it was really awesome because they had started those commercials, and it would start with a chance to live longer. And my son would go running through the house. That's my mommy's on an immunotherapy drug. She's going to live longer. Tear works immediately. Oh. But I remember saying to my oncologist, they're going to give him Opdivo. Why would he come to do it at a clinical trial versus getting it in standard of care at his oncologist? And the way it was explained to me is, in the clinical trial, they are currently working on version 3 of Opdivo. In the clinical setting, you're getting phase 1 and 2 of that drug. Wouldn't you rather get version 3 or 4 than version 1 or 2? I kind of know what my answer would be there. So always learning more from the drugs. So just because I was on a phase 1, I would hope that eventually Genentech would come back out with a phase 2, 3, and 4 of the same drug that they have reworked how the study is set up. And when it gets FDA approval, it can stay FDA approved.
So you and I being testaments of this immunotherapy is enough for me to just pray that it does again become FDA approved, because it's not fair, right, that newly diagnosed thrivers don't have this as an option right now. I think anybody who's listening that does have the same triple negative subtype. I think it's important to know your options. I think it's important to research this specific clinical trial because, as Stephanie said, it can't hurt to do the research and to ask. And if you can potentially join the clinical trial that Stephanie is on right now, it does have the potential to save your life, as it did for her and as it did for me. And so even though it's not FDA approved in this moment, I still think that even bringing it up to your oncologist and having your oncologist maybe do some of that research for you would be beneficial in the long run. And I will continue to pray that it makes its way back, because I think everybody deserves a happy ending, a happy outcome, a semi-normal life with a drug that's keeping the cancer away. I think everybody deserves that. And so I will continue to pray that it makes its way out there.
And to Ren's point, I think you need to ask your doctors about anything that you read with big companies, big pharma companies. Even if it's not approved, if it exists, there are avenues. It doesn't always work, but compassionate use avenues where you're signing away that you know this is, you know, a shot in the dark, but it might be the shot in the dark that works. So always ask, because there's always scientific improvements. I think looking at in HER2, that's the big one right now, that they're finding that a drug that was for HER2 actually works in HER2 low. And I think it's Verzenio or Ibrance. They're finding it, one of them crosses the blood-brain barrier and may actually have some benefit in HER2 or triple positive disease, not just triple neg. So Stephanie shared earlier, there's some thought that PD-L1 turns on and off. And so depending on when you get a targeted therapy, it may or may not work. The more that we learn about this, the more that there's research, the more that there might be a multitude of applications of drugs that exist or drugs that we didn't think worked well, but now they do because we know more about it. So once again, just highlighting the importance of advocacy and the importance of science, research, action.
Absolutely. And if there's one thing that you take from today's episode, it's advocating for yourself. It's asking the hard questions. It's seeking out to individuals. You could be the most annoying person in the world, but if it saves your life, then it was worth it. Like, you be that pain in the ass, like Stephanie was, like Kate was, like I am. Like, we need to be, you know, we need to have that drive to get through it, and so that we can be sitting here on the other side. And so transitioning into that, Stephanie, once you're given a short timeline of what's left of your life, we all start to live differently, right? What did this diagnosis change for you and how you approach life?
The night I was told that I only had 7.5 months, my husband at the time and I came home. We got my son. We went bowling for the first time. We stopped and got a pizza on the way home and put out a blanket in the middle of the living room and sat and had a picnic. And it was just, I'm going to live this life the best that I can live it. And I'm going to understand everything that these doctors are saying to me. I am not going to let them talk over me, above me, whatever way, except for answering my questions and me knowing exactly what was happening in my body and what the options were, because no option wasn't an option as far as I was concerned. And when I was told there was no options, I found it.
It makes me so teary.
It was the picnic that just sent me.
Ugh, I'm going to try not to cry. I think people don't understand.
You okay? Are you okay?
Yeah. How fragile things are. And you think when you're told you only have a limited time that you're going to do these really grand things, and you're not, you're going to do the things that you love. And that's time with family and memories and the little things in life. And that just, that makes me teary.
My son, with some of the moms that have recently been diagnosed now that met me when I was going through my initial treatments and stuff, and he is there for those mom's kids because he's been living with this since he was 2. And so now there's this 12-year-old friend that he's known since he was like 6, 7 years old. and he's able to be there, which to me is so sad that these kids are having to do it. But at the same time, what better way for this kid to be able to express his fears than to another kid whose mom has gone through the same thing, and it's been a great outcome. So I am grateful for that. But wow, it is overwhelming to think about it sometimes, for sure.
And I'm so grateful that your son has that friend, because we all need that friend, you know?
Oh yeah. I think, Ren, when you first reached out to me and I fully grasped what you were saying to me about you did this phase one trial and all these years later, I was able to get it in the clinical setting and it saved my life too. I was like hyperventilating, crying, like to hear that after all the fears and being told there was nothing else and finding it. And then what? So I started 8 years later to meet somebody that it worked on YouTube. It was, wow, overwhelming.
I can definitely agree to that. I remember being in tears at the mechanics. And I remember even just the look on my husband's face. Like, I'm not sure that you really understand the hope that you provided for both me and him. Like, I remember looking at him and he just had like this relief that took over him. Like, wow, my wife's going to be okay. And it was all due to just that one story. Like, once we heard 7 years and they're like, just the similarities between us, right? Like similar ages and the same subtype and the same immunotherapy. It just like the stars aligned. And I just remember we both teared up and it was just silence. You know, he just like squeezed my hand, but like, I knew exactly what he was feeling in that moment. And, yeah, so I'm eternally grateful that you decided to do that news article, because it brought me to you, and you're just this like this light for me. You like help me keep going, because I know that I can, if you can get to 7 years, 10 years, like I can do that too. And I hope that all of our listeners feel that way too, because it's just important to highlight how remarkable you are. And you've really been a big part of my journey. And so I'm thankful for you.
I am thankful for you both. And wow, it's truly humility. I mean, I feel humble for all of it.
So I think, Stephanie, to that point and to Ren's point, 10 years in MBC that's a unicorn. You know, those people, while becoming more common with advancements, are still not the norm. The stats are still not great. And so to find a 10-year survivor is amazing, and it's inspiring to anyone in this community. But to find what a triple negative 10-year survivor, I think just sharing your story is going to do so much good for the community, in knowing that despite what you might hear, you're not a statistic. You don't have an expiration date that's the same as the person next to you. That's such a bad thing that doctors say. If you don't ask for it, certainly some people do, but to just give somebody a date arbitrarily, there's so many factors that go into cancer and to response. And I think you are a testament to not only that, you know, your genetic makeup and however your cancer responded is a huge part of this, but your tenacity and your determination to find something and to not be what you were told, your story is not what you were told, is just, that's going to bring so much hope, I think.
Yeah, you essentially took what the doctor told you and told them to shove it, and I'm all for it. So I wanted to ask you, how does it make you feel knowing that this trial that you took part in and are currently taking part in paved the way for others like myself and other newly diagnosed thrivers or just thrivers in general?
Humble, for sure. I mean, something that I sat down in a pool with my kids saying, it's gonna get worse, but it can get better, and mommy can be here so much longer, to see that it worked on me, to see that it's working on others, is just, whew, not at all like when you're a kid looking forward and seeing all the things that are going to happen in your life. That's not one.
Well, I'll ask you one better. How does it feel to be sitting here as a 10-year metastatic triple negative breast cancer thriver?
Amazing. And wanting to go out and, I mean, hope, like, this podcast, making sure everybody, it is possible. Don't listen to when the doctor says, oh, it's just not in the cards for you. Fuck off. You don't know my hand. I mean, it has to come from you ultimately, right? It's your body that's trying to kill you. So who else can tell you how that's going to work out?
So Stephanie, with what you just said about feeling humbled, paving the way, you kind of are looking back at that original conversation with your five-year-old in the pool, which I'm going to stop even thinking about that because it's making me cry. But you're here now and you have, you know, all these years behind you. And Ren and I have talked about before that when you exceed that, you know, deadline or expiration date that you were given, you do kind of start to have moments where I think before cancer, you just live. You're going from one moment to the next. You're working your job. You're doing things. And you don't always take time to experience or feel what you're doing. And since my diagnosis, and especially since I've hit that mark, I kind of have these moments, even in simple things, where you just kind of, it hits you that, like, I wasn't supposed to be here for this. And that's crazy. It's weird. It's emotional. But do you have those moments, like, 10 years later? Do you still have that, like, I wasn't supposed to be here kind of feeling? And how, if you do, like, how does that make you feel? Do you have the same, like, Ren and I, it's like, you don't know what to do with it, but you're grateful kind of thing?
Absolutely. I mean, always grateful. I mean, for all of it, because, I mean, none of us are promised tomorrow. My stepmom once said to me that same kind of thing, you know, we all have to face death sometimes. And then she held her hand, like, literally palm to her nose. And she's like, but you have had death, like, right here for years. And been able to deal with it through grace and dignity and learning whatever I can about my own treatments. I'm not relying on just my doctors and my teams to come to me with things. I mean, when I first had my first brain med, I was researching radiation seeds that they can plant in your brain. My oncologist was like, Stephanie, you have to stop. I'm like, no, stop. Stop what? Stop living? No. There's no stopping here, doc. Keep moving forward. Keep up.
I love that. Keep up.
I mean, right? Yeah, I look at my kid on a daily basis, and especially now when he's starting to hit his growth spurt and he's almost as tall as me and his feet are bigger than me. And I saw him as just this little itty bitty thing, that this was not going to be his story, period. I am grateful for every second. And I'm kind of cheesy when it comes into, there is a lot of not so much beauty in this world today. And it is really hard to find the happy, especially from literally at the cellular level. You hurt. It's not just a muscle pain or a bone pain. I say at the cellular level, it hurts. But finding that happy, finding that beauty, finding the thing that's going to make you giggle the most. Oh, I am on a forever Easter egg hunt for that.
Beautifully said. And I don't have kids yet, but I will say that, like, my two puppers, they really, you know, they were that push for me, of course, like my husband as well. Like, you have things that push you in the direction of I'm going to get shit done. And I've experienced that before, the whole like moments of, wow, I wasn't supposed to be here. A lot of mine are usually during some of the bigger holidays. I know Kate and I, we've talked about this in previous episodes. There are some times where I'm just like, what the fuck's happening right now? It's just like pure disbelief where you're just like, you know, even, you know, this summer, oh my goodness, it'll be 5 years since my early diagnosis. And when I had first walked into my oncologist's office, just like the majority of oncologists, she told me that at most I would have 5 years. And, you know, I know that this episode isn't about the context in which oncologists explain things to you, but, you know, if there's one thing that I could change, it would be that, because I just think back to that moment and I'm just like, no, no, like you don't have the right to consider me a part of these statistics that you're reading. You don't have the right to put a timeline on my life. And so when I do have those moments where I'm like, I know that I wasn't supposed to be here, but I found this immunotherapy and the gratitude that sinks in regularly, that I'm fortunate enough to be on this drug that's left me 3 years NED, I just sit there and I'm like, all right, let's continue to do cool shit and make the most of my time while I'm still here. And I'm just kicking ass. And so I am manifesting 10 years. I am manifesting it. And then I'm going to manifest 20, 30, and I'm gonna be 98 like you, Stephanie. You just watched.
Oh yeah.
So I think we can come full circle and just hone in on the fact that this diagnosis is not yet a chronic one, even though the three of us are manifesting that it is and will continue to do that. But as Kate said before, it can be. And that is why we do this. And regarding this specific situation, you and I, Steph, like we are testaments to the power of research and the importance of funding and just the awareness of drug and like clinical trial options. And I don't know, I'm proud to take the time and acknowledge clinical trials for what they are, because, you know, when you have a subtype like ours, there are only a few treatment options available, which means as you've advocated for yourself very well, I might add, you have to know how and what to ask for, what to even look for regarding like what might work for you, what, you know, might not. And so it, you kind of have to be educated enough and do your research so that you can put that foot forward and advocate for yourself. And so Stephanie and like all the other survivors and thrivers out there that are taking part in clinical trials, you guys are essentially paving the way and just making it possible for others like me and whoever else to get FDA-approved life-saving treatment in the future. And that's huge. And like Stephanie, you and I, like with triple negative, like we're fortunate enough to have positive stories with, at in this moment, positive outcomes. But shouldn't everyone have that opportunity? And it's like, I hate that. I hate that that's not the case with MBC. And this is why we, in fact, call for action. And Stephanie, like, you will never know how grateful I am that I saw your interview on the news that day. It's like, just think about all the people right now in this moment. And even when we post your story on our segment on Instagram, like, if you really just think about how much hope you're providing to other people today, right here in this moment, like, you are a 10-year long-term metastatic triple negative breast cancer survivor, despite what the bullshit statistics say. And your story is empowering for all of us in the MBC community. So on behalf of Kate and I, thank you for being here today. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for advocating yourself so that you could join that clinical trial and I could be on that same medication kicking ass just like you are. You will for sure just continue to be my light and that glimmer of hope. So thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Thank you. I don't think I am nearly worthy enough, but wow. Wow.
Yes, thank you. It just a huge thank you. It is inspiring to hear it. I think it's going to reinforce that what we know is that things don't work for everybody. But to your story, you were told there's nothing we can do, and there was something. It just took some extra pushing, and so I think that's always going to be a story that is worth telling. That you don't have to let always somebody else tell you that you're done, and somebody else telling you, no matter how skilled or how much of an expert they are, it doesn't mean that they're right. Like you said earlier, they're practicing medicine. I do want to take, as we wrap up, a quick moment to thank the 24 metastatic triple negative breast cancer thrivers that volunteered to participate in this month's segment. For anybody who's seen, we featured a new thriver every day. And they're telling us their story. They're telling us the best advice. And they're sharing with the community why they advocate. And Ren and I will continue to be a broken record about the importance of advocacy, both for yourself and for the community. And whichever avenue you take as far as advocacy, is making a difference for you, for others. It's so important. So we hope that you've really enjoyed this segment this month. But we do want to give a shout out to those participants. Ren, obviously our co-host, was a participant. Deltra, Kim, Jen, Michelle G, Stephanie M, Michelle, Amy, Daniela, Mallory, Michelle A, Brigitte, Laura, Cheryl, Kara, Shelley, Caitlin, Marianne, Val, Brooke, Raven, Lisa, Karen, and of course you, Stephanie.
Yeah, this segment has been very inspiring, touching, moving, all the things, and just the fact that every one of these thrivers took the time out to send us their responses and just how meaningful and impactful each of them were. Kate and I truly appreciate it. So again, thank you to everybody for participating.
Before we wrap up, I want to reiterate what Ren did in the beginning of the episode. If you go to our Instagram page, we have the linked BCRF fundraiser for triple negative. BCRF does amazing things. They have really dedicated research funding for metastatic breast cancer, and this is specifically for triple negative research. So if you have anything that you can give, anything makes a difference. I know that I've taken my normal treat yourself after treatment money, where I usually get, you know, Starbucks and a cupcake. I've given it to this fundraiser. So anything helps. It's making a difference. So check out that link in our bio. And if you can, please donate.
Yes, absolutely. And so Stephanie, I actually did just remember that I wanted to give you just a brief moment to mention any advice that you would give to any other person diagnosed with metastatic triple negative breast cancer who might be struggling. I think this would be a great way to close out the episode.
And the number one thing is advocacy for yourself, that nobody else is going to be able to write your story. Sure, there are experts. You don't always have to go to the huge cancer institutions. There's information sharing happening all across the oncology community. So it doesn't have to be as scary as headed off to Texas or wherever. There are so many options. It's just finding those and understanding it enough that you can make yourself comfortable, that you're not just completely turning your life over to this team of doctors and treatment options. That to me, I needed to understand, what does that mean? What does it mean when it works? What does it mean when it doesn't work? What is my next option from there? And when I was told there wasn't any, well, I went and found it. And I take pride in proving them wrong. My dad says I'm a blockhead, and I've always been like that. So kudos to me, I guess.
That's right. Kudos to you. Well, thank you again, Stephanie, for being here today. We appreciate you more than you know. And We look forward to seeing your post on our segment approaching in just a few days.
Awesome. Thank you guys both for doing this. I think it's amazing.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for tuning into our podcast, Living Our Breast Lives. Feel free to follow us on Instagram at Living Our Breast Lives, where we will share podcast updates, special dates, educational resources, and of course, health updates for those following the community's MBC journeys. Have questions, comments, or anything else you'd like answered on our podcast? Send us a message on Instagram. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts, and as always, choose kindness. Someone may look fine on the outside, but you never know who's actually struggling on the inside. Until next time, don't forget to live your breast lives.
God bless. Thanks, everyone.